You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear my second interview with the novelist Mary McGarry Morris. We first spoke a couple years ago. This time she has a new book out, and we had a really nice conversation. Born in Connecticut and raised in Vermont, Mary McGarry Morris was educated at Mount St. Joseph Academy in Rutland, and then the University of Vermont, and then the University of Massachusetts. Mary's first novel, Vanished, was published in 1988, and it was nominated for the National Book Award and the Penn Faulkner Award. A Dangerous Woman was published in 1991 and was chosen by Time Magazine as one of the five best novels of the year, and it was made into a motion picture starring Deborah Winger, Barbara Hershey, and Gabriel Byrne. Songs in Ordinary Time was published in 1995, and then 2 years later it was chosen as an Oprah's Book Club selection, which propelled it to the top of the New York Times bestsellers list for many weeks, as well as making it an international bestseller. Songs in Ordinary Time was made into a CBS television movie starring Sissy Spacek and Beau Bridges. The highly acclaimed Fiona Range was published in 2000, followed by A Hole in the Universe in 2004, The Lost Mother in 2005, and The Last Secret, which is the book that we discussed in our first interview in 2009. Mary McGarry Morris is married to Michael W. Morris, who's an attorney, and she's the mother of five children and 12 grandchildren, grandmother to 12, sorry. And she lives on the North Shore in Massachusetts. Her most recent novel and the book we discussed is Light from a Distant Star, published in September by Crown. The book concerns Nellie Peck, a girl on the cusp of adolescence. She's gangly, awkward, and full of questions, but she's keenly observant and wiser than many of the adults in her life. The person she most admires is her father, Benjamin, who's a man of great integrity. His family's century-old hardware store is failing, and Nellie's mother has had to go back to work. Nellie's older half-sister has launched a disturbing search for her birth father. Often saddled through the hot summer days with her timid younger brother Henry, Nellie is determined to toughen him up, and herself as well. Three strangers enter Nellie's protected life. Brooding Max Devaney is an ex-con who works in her surly grandfather's junkyard. Reckless Bucky Saltonstall has just arrived from New York City to live with his elderly grandparents. And finally, pretty Dolly Bedelia is a young stripper who rents the family's small rear apartment and becomes the titillating focus of Nellie's eavesdropping. When violence erupts in the lovely Peck house, the prime suspect seems obvious. Nellie knows who the real murderer is, but is soon silenced by fear and the threat of scandal. The truth as she sees it is shocking and unthinkable, and with everyone's eyes riveted on her in the courtroom, she finds herself seized with doubt. No one will listen to her, no one believes her, and a man's life hangs in the balance. So that's the basic structure of the novel. And when we spoke, I began by asking Mary McGarry Morris what had inspired her to write Light from a Distant Star.
It began the way my books usually begin, with just a sense of different things that had happened in the past and wondering about them and knowing I wanted to, it was time to write another book. And the truth was something I kept thinking about. Does truth exist objectively? How can we prove truth? But again, with that, there was also the sense of a young girl who really wanted to be strong, who wanted to be tough, and that turned out to be Nellie Peck, mm-hmm. the main character in the book.
Yeah, and I love Nellie. I think she's a wonderful narrator. She's a little bit awkward. She's a very young teen, 13. And she's observant and curious about the world. And it's funny because when you and I last spoke, you made the comment that writing from the perspective of a child is interesting because children question so much, and that's what an author does when writing. So I was just wondering if we could talk a little more about that, because in reading the book, I thought, oh, that's really true. It must be fun to write from the perspective of a child, you know, for that reason.
Well, particularly because children are so often overlooked.
Yes.
In an adult world, as much as in our society, children are probably overindulged, honored, but they are also, particularly in Nellie's home, things are very difficult for her, for her family, and so she finds herself at this point in the summer where she's very much on her own and has to take care of her younger brother, and I found that very interesting, too, the 13-year-old girl who suddenly has to be quite responsible mm-hmm. before she's ready.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned her family has fallen into hard times. They have financial problems. Her parents are fighting. All of that is set up before a sort of pivotal act of violence that occurs that will become a focal point in the novel. And I wondered if you intentionally put the Peck family under that much pressure ahead of this moment in order to bring them to a point of vulnerability. Did you do that on purpose?
Well, what I wanted to do in beginning the book, looking back on my notes, I've seen that the first two words I wrote when I was trying to decide what the story would be about, I'd written heroism and courage, and I knew it was going to be about a young girl and mm-hmm. her family.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my books are very character-driven. I was very interested in Nellie Peck and the Peck family, and so that was a natural to explore their background and who each of the Pecks are, and where how these things have happened to them and their family, and that they are a very ordinary American family.
Mm-hmm.
The father has, Benjamin Peck has run his family's hardware store throughout his adulthood, but it's a store that had been in the Peck family for almost 100 years, and it's been important in town for as long, but of course, like so many small businesses, it's been forced into, well, almost failure by the big box stores. And Sandy Peck, Nellie's mother, she was a stay-at-home mom, but circumstances have forced her back out working. And she's very torn because she's very much a mother. She is very domestic, and she doesn't like the fact that her children don't have her presence anymore in the home. So, you know, I don't know that she's always so bitter, but she does deeply love her husband Benjamin mm-hmm. and always has. So mm-hmm. These circumstances are very difficult for her.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, looking at the way that the family fits together, it felt so right and so natural that she would have married someone like Benjamin, because he's really very different from her father, and you know, we get told that women will marry their fathers, or they'll marry the exact opposite of their fathers. And the other thing that I really noticed was how much Henry, Nellie's brother, is sort of like their father. You know, he's a little bit vulnerable. He's a bit of a dreamer. Did you do that on purpose, or did they just kind of come to you fully formed?
Well, of course, some characters come fully formed, and others I learn about as I go. And I realized as I wrote that, of course, shy and timid Henry would mirror his father in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
His intellect, his interest in the small, obscure things, which is the same as his father.
Mm-hmm.
But not a very practical man, Benjamin Peck, and Henry, his son, is probably going to be the same way.
Mm-hmm. Right, but a sweetheart, both of them. So.
Very likable characters.
They're very likable. Do you take a lot of notes about who you want your characters to be as you're going, or do you just sort of do a first draft where you let the story tell itself to you?
I do it both ways. In this book, and often each book follows its own, has its own method. with this book, I started off drafting the story or outlining the story, but in the process of that, oftentimes comes the whole patches of the story. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens once I actually get into the narrative. I will have a character who I need to understand. The character is there, but I need to get into it and at this character more deeply. And so oftentimes I'll just start trying to understand him or her by writing about them in an outline form. And often from that also comes another patch of narrative that will end up in its entire form in the book. Mm-hmm. So I didn't intend it to be that way.
Okay. All right. Before I ask you to read a few pages, I think we should talk a little bit about Max. He's a very important character in the book, and he, from the very first page, I believe, where Max enters the scene, Nellie is very taken with him. She loves the fact that he actually listens to her, which isn't true of all the adults in her life. So how did you first come to think about Max?
I felt at that point in beginning the story that Nellie was very much in need of a hero in her life. Her father has been her hero for 13 years, but things are slipping a bit, and there is her sister is critical. Everyone in the family, except Henry, seems critical of the father. And when Nellie meets Max, the handyman who comes to work in her grandfather's junkyard, he seemed to be everything that was needed in her life at that point. I felt she was actually, as the saying goes, ripe for a hero. Mm-hmm. When she met him with his dog Boone, Max Devaney and his dog Boone, there was she's a very intuitive character, Nellie Peck.
Right.
And she just had an instant sense about him. And I had written in my notes that Max was alone and unknowable, impenetrable, a wounded, hounded creature. Mm-hmm. That was the kind of person who would appeal to Nellie with her great imagination. She's very empathic when it comes to, well, animals and people. Mm-hmm. And early on in the book, too, he saves her brother from harm. And so he, in her mind, becomes the hero that she's been looking for. And the other thing was, when it comes to Nellie and the need for a hero and Max Devaney, she has come across a book in her father's study that belonged to her great uncle who had died in World War II. And the name of the book was Get Tough.
Right.
Written by Major F.E. Fairbairn. And it is an actual book. A book that I had, actually.
I thought it must be a real book.
It's a fascinating book. And when I came across it as a young girl and studied the holes and the positions and the descriptions of the most awful things you could do to an enemy combatant, I felt empowered in a very, very brutal way. I felt I could strangle someone and poke out their eyes, and perhaps growing up with three brothers, that was a necessary thing to know. but you know, that's something that often boys have access to, though I think that's changing now, that kind of empowerment, that physical empowerment. Girls don't. Mm-hmm. And that's the part I think that's changing. Most girls don't have that. That's not encouraged oftentimes for many girls. And so Max, given all of that, Max was perfect to enter her life at that point. Everything kind of came together in the presence of Max.
Well, I wonder if maybe now is a good time for you to read a couple pages from the book.
Okay, sure. In this scene, Nellie is in her grandfather's junkyard, and she's very interested, of course, in Max, always has been, always wants to know about him. And her grandfather's going to go in and take a nap. Max is throwing a tennis ball for his dog, Boone, to retrieve. If a dog can be ecstatic, Boone surely was. Waiting, his tail beat the dirt. Then with the ball's release, he took off, grinning, she thought. A few minutes later, her grandfather Charlie said he was going in for a snooze. After he left, Max slapped his thigh and said, "Well?" He looked slowly around the yard. "Well, what?" Nellie wondered, slowly realizing "well" meant it was time, time for her to go. Whimpering low on his haunches, Boone kept picking up the ball and flipping it into the air, desperate for Max to throw it again. Max just sat there. Nellie shared Boone's hunger for the dark-eyed man's attention, a word, a look, anything. She picked up the ball. Wanting to engage both dog and master, she threw it hard as she could down past the barn. Boone whimpered and wiggled, but never stood or chased it. Max's wait continued in the uneasy stillness. As much as he wanted her to leave, she was determined to stay. "How come he won't go get it?" "He knows not to." "How?" "I got work to do," Max said. "That's okay. I can help. I'm a pretty good worker." "You better be going now," he gestured at the house. "Charlie's inside." "I'll just wait. I don't care. Nothing else to do," she said. He got up. Boone stayed put, but she followed Max into the barn. He turned. "Go on back out," he said. Ordinarily, his pock-whiskered scowl would have sent her running, but not then. "I'll be quiet. You shouldn't be in here." "Charlie lets me." His mouth puckered with sourness. "Well, Charlie ain't here." "So? Don't be talking to me like that, okay?" he growled and went outside. "I'm sorry," she said, close on his heels. She really was. "I was just wondering about your brother, that's all. What you said about tracking deer. How'd he get shot?" He started digging again. The shovel scrape and ping through the gravelly dirt gave her the shivers. She knew she should go, knew he didn't like it, but leaving would be an admission. She just wasn't sure of what. Mostly she felt let down, sad, without knowing why. Something needed saying, but it wasn't up to her. She was the kid, after all. We were going over a stone wall. Him first, then me. He was a year younger than me, 12, but always faster, smarter, too. We'd been out all day. By then, it was getting late. In spite of the way it played out in his voice, distant and labored with the rhythm of methodical digging, she saw them, the two brothers, burst from the dusky woods, panting the dry crunch of brush underfoot as they raced each other. "Almost supper time. Not that it mattered," he grunted, and dug his back to her the whole time. "I mean, Merrill, he'd have lived in the woods if he could, eating squirrels and snakes, frogs. He didn't care, but not me. All I wanted was to get back. I started running. He went first. Nothing to it. I mean, the wall couldn't have been but 2.5 feet, but I mustn't have been looking. My foot caught, snagged kind of in between the rocks, and down I go," which is when it happened. "The gun going off. Just that one shot. I don't know," he paused, foot on the shovel. "Hard to figure." The gun blast. She heard it too, still was in her bones. "That's awful," she finally said. "Yeah, they never got over it, especially my mother. But it wasn't your fault." "To them it was," he said, jamming his foot down on the shovel hard. She must have left soon after that. She wasn't sure what more was said, or even if she said goodbye. The most she would remember were the sweat circles darkening his back as he kept on digging and digging, not for, but against something.
Thank you. Thank you for reading that, Mary. That's great.
You're very welcome.
It's funny, you know, having you read that just heightens for me little things that I noticed as I was reading the book, and now I'm seeing even more of them. There are just so many moments where Nellie is incredibly astute about what other people are feeling or what they're thinking. She's very empathic. And
yes.
Yeah, and I think that's so important in her being the narrator of this particular book and the role that she plays as the book continues. And the fact that she's a good judge of character, even right down to she sort of sees Boone in a personified way, that he looks like he's grinning, and then later in the book he looks like he might cry. You know, she's just incredibly empathic.
She loves animals, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, in life and in fiction, the way people treat children is just so important in sort of assessing character, you know, and you watch how people treat children and you kind of have a sense of who they are. And the way that Max is with her, you kind of come to understand what kind of man he is. I just think it's a really interesting relationship you created there between the two of them.
Thank you. With her father, too, he's the kind of parent that kind of child needs, who tells you things, who really listens, who is interested in the most minor matters,
right,
the most impractical things.
Right, but the drop of the hat wants to take them on a little adventure here or there.
Right, they'll go get spring water, and he's in the middle of the night, things
yeah.
like that.
You know? Yeah. Your use of detail is very exact and precise. This is just one teeny tiny example. There's a character named Dolly who is renting an apartment from Nellie's family. And she's a lovely young woman, and it turns out that she's a stripper in a nearby strip club. And she's offered to do Nellie's hair and makeup in this scene. And this is just a single sentence from that section. Nellie panicked, seeing the mass of crimped tubes and bottles, brushes and tools Dolly was dumping out of her soiled makeup bag. You know, just reading that, I just was so impressed. I mean, just one sentence and you get so much information in about who Dolly is and the way she lives her life. So I'm wondering if you can talk about your use of detail in description and how hard do you have to work to find just the right details? Do you really labor over it?
Sometimes. Some characters and some scenes are very easy to get into, and other times in understanding exactly what's going on, I will slow way, way down and have to be very much in that other place that I'm writing about and pay close attention to what it looks like and smells like and sounds like and exactly what would be there, what would be happening. And in this case, seeing it from the point of view of a 13-year-old girl, too, was very important. There's often the author looks down from above and can put in his or her own details, but it's always important to remember really who the narrator is and who is seeing these things and experiencing these things. And I had to be 13 oftentimes and
yeah.
react to things that way.
Right. Now, is that a process for you, putting yourself into the mind of a 13-year-old? I mean, or is that just something that comes, you know, you can do that sitting in your chair?
Well, I think because childhood is in all of us, we've all in life had a childhood. Everyone
yeah.
has had a childhood.
Right.
We've had different experiences in the childhood, but we've all been 7 or 8, and so it's easy oftentimes to revisit that, to go
yeah.
back there and to dig back there oftentimes and try to remember what it felt like and what it was like. And I think readers react to that too, because it brings up images from their own childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just, you know, the sentence I read, the thing that really blew me away was the soiled makeup bag. I mean, we've all seen a soiled makeup bag. Sometimes it's our own and we have to replace it. It's time to replace the bag. But I would never have really thought of making that that level of specificity. It was just so perfect. Anyway.
Thank you so much. Well, it's so typical of Dolly, too. So typical
yeah.
of Dolly Bedelia, who was so careless in everything about her life. Just young, silly, careless, and really quite sweet at times, and also could be quite vicious at times, too.
Yep. Right, yeah. And actually that scene leads into a couple of different moments for Nellie where she's feeling conflicted about having makeup put on, which she knows her mother wouldn't approve of. She's also sort of enjoying that moment of sisterly, you know, interaction with Dolly. But then later Dolly sort of pushes her away and isn't very nice, you know, in following up about the makeup and hair. And, you know, without having read the book, people won't know what I'm talking about. But it is a scene that opened up a whole lot of interaction between them that was very interesting. So,
and Nellie can be annoying, too, which is part of it.
Sure. You know, and that was...
She can pester a person.
Yeah, she can, but it's funny to write from the point of view of the pesterer and to get that across. That's fun too. Now Nellie's father is writing a history of their town, and it's an activity that really engrosses him and actually keeps him from putting more effort into earning a living. And at one point he considers or he really wants to let a vanity press publish his book, and that would cost a great deal of money. So this is actually not a question about Benjamin. This is a question about the desperation to get published. I'm wondering, early in your career as a writer, was it difficult to get published, and did you ever consider self-publishing? And is that what you drew upon to write that part of Benjamin's life?
Early in my career, publishing my first book was very difficult. I had a very hard time. It took a long time to get anyone who was interested in my first book vanished. And so, yes, I do understand that real need, and I see it oftentimes now. I know young, especially young people who are writing and anxious to get published. And I know that the idea of self-publishing wasn't available when I was starting out, and I think that's a wonderful thing for a great venue for young writers today. They have that. That's mm-hmm. something that can be done. You know, that was not available to me and others writing when I was, but also in Benjamin's quest to write and to get published. I very much sympathized with and felt his great belief in, not only in himself and in his work, because I also had a great belief in my work, if not always in myself. And I think that's very, very important for a writer to keep believing in their work. And, of course, with Benjamin, he's confident that act of creation, once it's out there and reaches the world, will change the circumstances of his life and his family's life. And of course, reading it, we know it probably won't. There won't be too many readers who will want to read about his town of Springvale in its many volumes.
Yeah.
But there is that sense that if you can just, this creative act is so important, and it's a real drive in a writer, you know, that you must do this, and once you do it, once you've accomplished it, everything will change, everything will be different, better, and it's what keeps you going. And then you finish one book and it's the same drive again, back it comes.
Right, to the next book. Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to just quote from a review of one of your earlier books. The Rocky Mountain News said, Mary McGarry Morris has a brilliant talent for exploring the dark side of normalcy. And the last time you and I spoke in our interview in 2009, when I asked about this project that you were working on at the time, you called it a novel about ordinary people. No, I'm sorry, a novel about an ordinary family, lovely people, who are coming on hard times. At one point in this book, when a front window in their neighborhood is smashed, actually it's the apartment that they own, a front window is smashed by a rock that's been thrown by somebody, Nellie reflects that things like that never happened here, not on Oak Street, not to them. So I wonder, all of these things are coming together here in a question. What do you suppose keeps people feeling insulated by normalcy, and why is the interruption of normalcy such a draw for readers, do you think?
Well, because for those who everyone seeks a safe, normal, secure life. And for those who feel they have it, there's always the sense, the uncertainty about life. Life is so uncertain that anything, you know, could happen. Any bad thing could happen and change all that. And again, that's a child's awareness. That's, mm-hmm. that always comes as a surprise, I think, to a child, that life isn't everything that it appears to be. It's not the safe place that they've imagined it to be all these years. And simply, that's all that is. That's all
right.
That was for me. And I do feel it's a very ordinary family in a very ordinary time in an ordinary town with a terrible incident that happens in their lives.
Yeah, and I do think that people sometimes delude themselves into thinking nothing bad can happen to me because that happens to another kind of person or another place. You know, you read the paper and you hear about the terrible things that happen. You don't read the paper and say, oh, this person's just like me. So I think it's a protective mechanism, too. Yeah.
It definitely is. It definitely is.
Well, in all of your books, I think, Mary, you are really good at building suspense and using foreshadowing, and this novel is no exception. I noticed in this book there were a few times where you would say what Nellie would feel later. You know, later she would try to remember this moment in time. And we, you know, at the point that we're reading that sentence, we don't know what's going to happen. We just know that that this moment will become important after we read more. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about building suspense.
The very first chapter begins with the words, "And you still think so, even after all this time?"
Right.
The answer is absolutely. How can you be so sure? And that was the sense I had in writing the book and with the character who was probably, as I wrote it, a child, but a child who's grown up now and looking back on what's happened
mm-hmm.
in her life and questioning, trying to understand. And that second word, absolutely, was important for me to write and to see because, you know, what is absolute? What is absolutely? Particularly when it comes to facts and the things that really happened, you never really know.
Mm-hmm.
You can have all the data and all the facts, but it's all, everyone's perception is different. Everyone interprets the facts differently in life. You tell a story from your childhood now, and you have, or at the dinner table, and you'll have five different members of your family saying, "No, that's not the way it happened." And that's just was my sense in writing it, that there were things that were very important that had to be remembered that would pop up into her telling of the story, but they had to be remembered. Those were the important things.
Right.
So
right.
I think that's why.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm just I turned to page one while you were, you know, talking about it. And in order to turn to page one, I had to pass a couple of other pages, one of which is the title page, and it has a picture of a treehouse in a tree. And I didn't notice that when I read the book the first time. There is an important treehouse in the book, and the one in this picture does not look like it's going to hold all of those people that get in there at one point in the book.
No, it doesn't.
Whose treehouse is that? That's a great picture, though.
It is. The publisher found that, and I as I wrote, I had a picture of a large ramshackle treehouse taped next to my computer because that was very important. That treehouse, as it was in my own childhood, a treehouse, a very similar treehouse outside the apartment in the big old house that we lived in. And that my brothers had built the treehouse. There was that sense, as an adult looking back, I thought that was such a large treehouse. And a few years ago, when I went back and saw the tree that that treehouse had been built in, I realized it couldn't have been a very big treehouse. But in things you remember from childhood are always so much bigger and better and stronger.
Yes, exactly. That's great. So no wonder you can reimagine Nelly and be 13 again. You have a sort of treehouse you can go back and sit in your mind.
In my mind, yes.
In your mind.
The tree is there. In my mind, yes. We had, as I said, everyone's had a childhood, and there's so much that's there that's just ripe and comes up to the surface, especially for a writer when you need it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, the other page I noticed when I turned back to chapter one is your dedication page, and you are certainly covering all your bases with these dedications on this book. You've got like 15 people that you're dedicating the book to.
Yes. No one can say they were left out, at least my grandchildren.
Oh, that's
they're
it.
All my grandchildren.
Oh, fabulous. Okay, that's good. I was wondering who they were.
Yeah. Yes.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing from the narrative viewpoint of a man versus from that of a woman. You've written a number of novels, and you've written from the point of view of men, points of view of women, children, but I'm curious about specifically writing from the point of view of a man. Have you found that difficult in the past or very different?
I haven't. I've been... so far, anyway, very comfortable in the characters whose point of view, the male characters I've written written from. And I'm sure there are certain male types that I wouldn't be comfortable writing about, but the ones that I have so far, in Gordon in A Hole in the Universe, and Aubrey Wallace in Vanished, and in Songs in Ordinary Time, there were many male characters whose points of view were the book was told from. And it did come easily to me. But again, there were characters I had chosen, the personalities I was interested in and felt comfortable with. I'm sure if someone hands you some type of person and you don't like them or feel comfortable with them, I couldn't do it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I wonder if that's sort of why, for some writers, it's just not possible to kind of outline ahead of time and create in some sort of organizational chart the book that you want to write, because you're sort of handing yourself characters that you haven't developed yet. Sound right?
Well, I think you can do it for yourself. I know I have a sense of my next two books, actually. But I can't imagine having it foisted upon me, having it assigned. You know that I wouldn't. That would be hard work.
Yeah,
harder work than my kind of writing is for me. But yet I will say there are times when I've sat at the desk and thought, you know, if only someone would knock on the door and say, here's a great story. You want to listen to this one now. I've got a great novel for you. You know, I'm sure most writers have felt that one time or another. If only someone would walk through right now and hand it to me.
Right,
I'll do
exactly.
It.
Except that when people do say, I've got a great idea for a story for you, it's always like, no, you need to write that one. Can't write your story.
I know. It's interesting. People, particularly their personal stories, you look and think, I could never do that. You're right, Shayla.
Yeah.
It's theirs to write. It's not mine to tell.
Right. Now, I'm wondering, having you have written a number of books, so do you ever find that you have to be careful not to fall into a character you developed earlier, or that, you know, you're writing a character and you realize, oh, you know, this feels a little too much like that other man that I wrote about or that other woman that I wrote about?
It will happen during the writing. Things will be very familiar, and I'll think, oh, wait a minute, I've done this, I've said this. But that's okay, you know, that's the way life goes. That's all right.
Now, do you ever want to? Do you ever feel like I'm not finished with somebody and I want to maybe write a sequel to something or continue on in this one person's life?
really haven't felt that, and I'm often asked that, but I haven't felt that. I do feel when I come to the end of a book, the end of a story, that I'm at the end. I've said it the way I need to say it, and I couldn't imagine ending it any other way. And the thought of continuing on, maybe it's because I have other places I want to go with other stories and other characters, that the thought of, you know, returning to an old work and writing again about those characters, it feels that I wouldn't have time for that right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm very conscious of time and how much time I have left to get my books written.
Okay. Well, since we're sitting here chuckling, my next question has to do with writing humor. It's funny because I wouldn't say that I was, like, holding my sides laughing through this book, because I wasn't. But sometimes just these moments will come out, and all of a sudden it's just laugh out loud funny. One of them to me was... Benjamin is sort of apologizing to the neighbors because the children did something that was inappropriate, or they were involved actually in something that was inappropriate. It wasn't actually their fault, and I won't go into it, but he says he wants his children to understand that everybody's different, and he says, "We're all odd ducks, every single one of us, and they know that, right?" He peered down at his children. "Yes, sir," Nellie and Henry answered softly, in guilt and giddiness, afraid to look at each other. Their father saying they were all odd ducks had always been their signal to quack. Just like, I was so not expecting that line. It just made me laugh out loud. It was so funny to me.
Well, and that was such an important scene for me to be writing, because it was such a tense scene. It was such a difficult scene, given what was going on, the children who had harassed their neighbor, Tenley Humboldt, who he dresses in women's clothes in the privacy of his home, as they'd been told by their parents, and they had witnessed him doing that in his backyard. Mm-hmm. And so and again, it shows the idealism and the liberalism of their father, Benjamin, who, you know, they're going to go out, that's the way things are, and they're going to go over and apologize for bothering him the night before. And his sister Louisa, who's very protective of him, is very everyone is so uncomfortable in that scene. It was a very uncomfortable moment in the book for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was the way a child would feel, you know, that awful and that terribly tense moment, that awful giddiness that's below the surface that you don't dare laugh.
Right, exactly. So you sort of were breaking the tension for them and for you and for us all, too, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Another one that I just want to read one more, because it was just so funny to me. There's this moment where they're all working to clear a downed tree that's blocking the driveway. And it says, and some of the neighbors start to join in, and then it says, old Mr. Fuller shuffled over from across the street with his own chainsaw and started cutting the smaller branches, which made everyone nervous because he could barely see. Just, I don't know, it was just so perfectly delivered, that line.
Yes, he's legally blind. He's the neighbor who drives, but he's legally blind. And that's when they would see him coming around the corner. What the children would do would dive into bushes. But
right, they ride their buck.
And scolded for doing it. It was considered disrespectful.
Be respectful, but don't get hit.
Yeah.
You know, I think this gets, I think a little bit about the point of the humor in the book gets back to the Rocky Mountain News's comment about how well you explore normalcy, the dark side, but also the humorous side. You know, it's like these moments do, they come into our lives and they're very funny. And so it's I think very well done. You know, anything can come out of a normal moment in a normal family, and these funny moments just feel very organic, but very very well timed. I think.
So. Well, isn't that the way life is? Isn't that the way life is? You'll step outside your door today, and you'll encounter someone who will just blow your mind away or make you giggle or whatever. That's right. Just the way it goes.
It just happens unexpectedly. The book is written in the past tense, and obviously, anybody who's reading this novel knows that there is a big event that's going to happen at a certain point, either because they read the back cover or because they just have felt the tension building a little bit. And then this is the first sentence of chapter 11. So this is what happened, the way she remembers it anyway. And that sentence just so stood out. It just so made me sit up straight and think, okay, pay attention. And I thought that the tense change was something that was very interesting, but also just sort of the sort of frank acceptance, almost on the part of the book itself, that we've all been expecting something big to happen, and now we're going to find out more about it. And I wondered about writing that sentence. Did you just decide, okay, it's time to kind of make them all sit up and pay attention?
Well, and that brings me back to the first words of the first chapter, and
right.
You still think so, even after all this time. Absolutely. How can you be so sure? So she is telling how she can be so sure. She's telling what were the important details as she remembers them and as she considers them. And their importance and how relevant they are.
Yeah.
Again, that wasn't necessarily a planned sentence. It was just the way I wrote it.
But it's interesting that they're both in present tense, and even mm-hmm. though there are many, many pages in between, they sort of pull against each other and definitely become part of the same thread that's running through the book, that's a different thread than the other parts. I don't know if I'm saying that very well, but...
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, right. That was an interesting moment.
And it's when she's remembering, it said Ruth's letter must have come during that same rainy week. The ink on the damp envelope was smeared. She remembers standing on the porch. You know, it's that kind of, she also is getting into her memory, getting into mm-hmm. the story. And yet she's still 13. She allows herself to be 13 and she's going back there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, you mentioned a couple minutes ago that you have your next two projects sort of worked out in your mind. So I assume, are you working on one of them yet, or are you working on either of them yet?
I am. I'm a good way through my next book, which is as yet untitled.
Okay.
And it's from the point of view of, it's a single mother whose husband is... whose ex-husband doesn't contribute to the family and only shows up to harass and bother the family, from her point of view anyway, the mother. And life is hard. Life is very hard. And that's, she's doing her best. And she meets a woman who was a writer, a woman who is 90 years old but was a writer as a young woman. And she wrote under a pen name, and she's from a wealthy family, and it's a very interesting interaction between this struggling single mom and this rather haughty older woman who had to hide her writing from the world. So that's my next book.
You know, you have so much experience writing novels, and I'm wondering if you can offer advice for writers who may be in the middle of a first draft of maybe even their first novel and are feeling overwhelmed or just sort of unsure of the path that they've already started to take. And, you know, there's this sense of being mired in something that you're not sure if it's right or not. Do you still get that sense? And what advice do you have for people?
It still happens. I can still get that feeling of being mired in the middle of something and not sure where to go. My best advice to a writer who's experiencing that and to myself has always been to just keep going,
mm-hmm.
to write my way through it. And not to be afraid to, a week or two later, having written yourself through it, to go back and say, that didn't work at all, I'm throwing that out. And, you know, I've done that. You know, just, I have many, many pages that were removed because they didn't satisfy me or they felt wrong. It's a it's a difficult, again, you have to, it's about what I mentioned earlier, trusting your work. You have to have a real sense of it as an organic living thing that that you're putting together, and it does have to work. And when it works, you know it. And when it doesn't, you're in charge, and you mustn't be afraid to change it the way you need it to be.
Okay.
So I think that would be my simplest advice.
Well, that's great. That's great advice. And thank you so much for talking with me today. It was a pleasure, and I love the new book, Light from a Distant Star, and it's published by Crown.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed this.
That, again, was a conversation with Mary McGarry Morris. And you can learn more about her work at her website, marymcgarrymorris.com. This is just an announcement. The New England Independent Booksellers Association has awarded former Write the Book guest Howard Frank Mosher the President's Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Arts. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the work of my guest, Mary McGarry Morris, whose latest book, Light from a Distant Star, involves eavesdropping to some extent. The children in the book do a fair amount of eavesdropping. Whether she's listening through the walls or peering from a treehouse into her neighbor's yard, Nellie Pick is guilty of this crime. She discovers secrets in this way, and sometimes she sees and hears things that she later wishes she hadn't seen and heard. Your writing prompt this week is to eavesdrop. Take a seat next to two strangers in a cafe or restaurant, sit quietly with a pair of old friends in a bar, or even perch in a changing room at your department store and listen to the people who are in the next changing room. Not to get too weird. But anyway, see what people are saying to each other and see what you can learn about how people talk to each other. And this is not really meant necessarily be an exercise in studying dialogue, but learning how people tell each other their secrets and maybe gossip with one another, and how do their voices change? How do they protect themselves from seeming small or unkind if they are gossiping? Do they use any form of verbal foreshadowing to add tension to the ways that they share their secrets? Take notes, mentally or on paper, and see if you can use what you learn in your work. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You know, feel free to make comments on those two websites. You can do that at the Podbean website. You can also make comments on iTunes. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show, if you have news about book-related events, you're always welcome to send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I also accept writing prompts from people who might like to have their writing prompt suggested on the air. I will credit you with your prompt if I choose to use it. So that email address again is writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.